So welcome, everyone, to our Small Communities PA Learning. We have three more classes before we're going to take a little summer hiatus this week, next week, and the following week. And then the rabbis decided we're going to have a much-deserved little bein hazmanim, as they say in yeshiva lingo, a little bit of a break. And then hopefully we'll do something special Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur time. We have some ideas. But the final three classes are going to be tonight and the next two Mondays. And then we'll have a little summer break. So tonight's class, The Golden Calf, Welcome to the Grand Illusion. And I want to recognize that last night, yesterday, Shivasar B'Tammuz, the 70th day of Tammuz, was the 22nd Yortzeit, of my late Rosh Yeshiva Harav Shmuel Yaakov Weinberg, Zecher Tzadik Evracha, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of Neri Yisrael Baltimore, Neri in Baltimore. He passed away in 1999, and I want to dedicate the learning tonight. Should be an aliyah for his neshama, should be an elevation for his soul. And I just want to tell you a little bit about Rabbi Weinberg, just so you'll connect perhaps a little bit to who he was. So Rabbi Weinberg was unusual because he was a very conventional Litvish Rosh Yeshiva from Lithuania in Europe, descended from a very, very famous dynasty of rabbis, going all the way back to someone named the Rambam, Maimonides, so it was a very formidable yichus, genetics. But Rabbi Weinberg, not only was he a gaon, someone who was a giant in Torah learning, but he was also very, very worldly. He knew a lot about a lot of things. Now, we, as the yeshiva guys, we didn't see it. When we would go to his house on Yeshiva Lane, so all the books he had were conventional sfarim, Jewish books that you would see in a rabbi's study. Now, my wife gave me the inside scoop, you see, because my wife is part of his family. And she said she once was allowed down in the basement, below the deck. And down there, he kept his sort of non-traditional, non-Jewish sfarim, his books, and they were not Jewish books. They were everything. And he was an expert in philosophy and many other things. So legend has it, this is the story, that he was somehow at a sort of a cocktail party before a big class that he was giving, like a grand sort of a shiur in front of a very big convention. And at this sort of cocktail party, there are some very erudite people, including some very self-important Harvard professor. And the Harvard professor was arguing with another Jewish man about the famous philosopher Kant. And Rabbi Weinberg was sort of off to the side talking with someone else. And I guess the Harvard professor blew up the opinion that Rabbi Weinberg had told him that Kant had cited. And I guess he was a little dismayed because the Harvard professor was having none of it. And so at the first opportunity, the Jewish man who knew the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Weinberg, said, "Rabbi, would you, let me introduce you to this professor, so-and-so, okay?" And he says, I quoted you, Rabbi, to the professor, but apparently he's a professor of philosophy at Harvard, brilliant man. And he claims that it's erroneous. It's not true. Kant never said this. So Rabbi Weinberg looked at the professor. He said, he says, it's a common mistake. You see, the reason that you believe that he didn't say it is because you have the redacted English translation. But in the original German, which I possess in my basement, Kant actually said the following. He quoted it in German. That was the end of the discussion. So that was Rabbi Weinberg, just to give you a little sense of his knowledge base, okay? So again, I want to dedicate tonight to Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, Zecher Tzadik Ivracha. So there's a concept called nesting. And I apologize to my audience here live, but I'm going to be speaking a lot into the camera because the audience there is going to see me on the camera. And if I'm not making eye contact very often, you'll have to forgive me. I'm making eye contact with the blank screen that has my notes. But be that as it may, I'll do my best. So nesting is when, if you ever seen, and I meant to bring my wife's, and I always forget, do you know what Marushka dolls are? They're the little Russian nesting dolls. They start off, like with a doll about that big, and you keep taking off the dolls, and they get smaller and smaller and smaller, and you figure at some point there's no way there can be another doll, and there's like a little piddling, little pitzelach doll about that big. So there's like 15 dolls, and they're nested one within each other. They're called nesting dolls. So you take them out, it's like a performance, and you put them on a shelf, and you know, you have 15 dolls, and they all fit into the big mama doll. It's called nesting. History, Jewish history and world history, I believe, is nested, meaning that in the God game, which is eternity, he understands from the beginning until the end when things happen, why things happen, and it all makes sense. But to us, to the human perspective, when we are sort of privy to maybe some of the history, a little bit of the now, and zero of the future, we can't possibly understand the interrelationships as things play out over history. However, when we look back at history, then we see that certain events that were at the time not related, later on, it was clear in retrospect that in fact not only were they related, but they were inseparable. So I'm going to give you just something that is true Jewish history, just to cite the idea of nesting. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why we're here, which is yesterday's fast day, the seventh day of Tammuz, okay? So in 1492, I'm sure we're all familiar a little bit with the wicked Isabella and Ferdinand, who expelled the greatest Jewish center of the world, Spanish Jewry, were given basically a very finite amount of time to get out of Dodge, and they were summarily thrown out of Spain. The Spanish expulsion of 1492. It's a very dark point in Jewish history because we didn't know what would be the future. Spanish Jewry was the epicenter of all culture, everything we knew. And it was a very uncertain future at that moment. But little did we know, and again, this is nesting, little did we know that on Tisha B'Av, on the ninth day of Av, which is coming up in less than 3 weeks now, when the Jewish people were expelled from Spain, so you can only imagine it's sort of like the inverted Passover, right? Because we're not leaving for a happy purpose to go to freedom. We're leaving and trying to pick up our peklach and get out the door before we lose everything. We're grabbing whatever we can and we're getting on boats and ships and we're getting out of town. And the harbor, I dare say, in Spain, the main harbors were probably just absolutely jam-packed with boats and ships and Jews trying to just get out of Spain so they wouldn't be punished or even worse, killed by the Spaniards. So you can imagine how bleak it was. It's so bleak that it's a part of the ninth of Av, that we remember this, that it happened that day. But you know what's not known? But we know this now, that there were three ships, the Nina, the Maria, and the Santa Maria, the Nina, and the Pinta. And they were also leaving Spain right around that same time. In fact, it's possible, it's not necessarily true, but it's very possible that those three ships were kind of caught up in a traffic jam because the Jews were trying to get out and Christopher Columbus and his ships couldn't leave the harbor. But little did we know, how could anybody know except Hashem, except for God, that nested within the tragedy of the Spanish expulsion would be the next chapter. Okay, it's a little bit down the road still, a couple hundred years, but a couple hundred years, the foundation for future Jewish survival in our wonderful United States of America was already percolating. So here we were in this darkness that was enveloping us, and nested within that darkness was the light itself, salvation. That literally among the ships were the ships leading to an ultimate redemption for the Jewish people. So it's an amazing idea that was only clear in retrospect many, many moons later. Okay, so now how does this relate to our Shivasar B'Tammuz, the fast that we had yesterday? So as you can see at the top on source number one, and if everyone on, please could mute themselves, I would appreciate that very much. Thank you. So have a look at source number one. If you're looking on your screen, have a look, please. Source one. This is a quote from the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the abridged Jewish law. Very abridged, I might add. So he says like this, Rabbi Gansfried says, on the 17th day of Tammuz, there were five disasters. A, the tablets, upon which the Ten Commandments were written, the Luchot, were broken when Moses came down from the mountain. And then it talks about B, the daily temple offering was canceled. C, the walls of Jerusalem were breached during the destruction of the second temple, and perhaps even by the first temple. It's not clear. They mention the ninth of Tammuz, but it could be, according to some Mefarshim commentaries, that it might have also happened the seventh day. And then it mentions a couple of other events. A wicked Roman ruler, a posthumous, burned a Torah, an idol was set up in the temple. Okay. But look at A and C, and they're written chronologically. So if you are reading the Torah, if you're reading the Chumash, and you say, okay, what happened to originally make the seventh day of Tammuz a disastrous day, a sad day, a tragic day? You would say, Shviras Aluchos. Moshe destroyed the Ten Commandments, the two tablets. Now, if you ask a school child, what are we commemorating on the seventh day of Tammuz? You know what they're going to say to you? The breach of the wall of Jerusalem, because that began this process of called the Bein HaMitzarim, the 3 weeks between the narrow straits, culminating with the destruction of the temple on Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av, 3 weeks later. So in other words, you have this event, the 70th day of Tammuz, which was the breaking of the wall of Jerusalem much later. But where did it begin? The breaking not of the wall of Jerusalem, that didn't happen for hundreds of years. It was the breaking of the tablets. Oh. So that means that there must be an interrelationship between the first event that happened on Shivas Arba Tammuz, Seventh Day of Tammuz, which means the breaking of the Ten Commandments. That was the seminal original event, correct? And then hundreds and hundreds of years weiter, as saying Yiddish, in the future, you come to the walls of Jerusalem being breached in 586 or 592, Common Era, and then subsequently perhaps in the year 70, both walls. First Temple of Solomon, Second Temple. Okay. But you know what's also fascinating? In the Torah, 3 weeks later is Tisha B'Av, right? The destruction of the Jerusalem. But what event happened originally in the Torah? The spies. We read about it a couple parshas ago, right? The Meraglim, the spies come back from the land of Canaan. They tour for 40 days and 40 nights. They bring back this nefarious report about Israel. The Jewish people all cry, this bichiyah shechinam, this baseless cry. God says, what are you crying for? You're on the precipice of the promised land and you should be rejoicing. Oh, you're crying for no reason? Okay, fine. No, I'll give you a valid reason for future crying. And that night, Tisha B'Av was created, and all these calamitous events, like the destruction of the temples, etc., expulsion from Spain, all these calamitous events are destined to happen on the ninth of Av. But let me ask you a question. The 3 weeks begins with the 17th of Tammuz, breaking of the tablets with the golden calf. And then 3 weeks later, you have Tisha B'Av, which was originated by the spies. Is there a connection between the breaking of the tablets and the spies? Well, in the Torah, there isn't. There is no relationship at all in the Torah between these two events. But clearly, if one begins and one ends the process of the 3 weeks with these two events, what is God saying? Of course they're interrelated. So that's a little bit off our schedule tonight. What I would like to do is talk about the interrelationship between the seventh day of Tammuz, the golden calf, and how perhaps, how that relates to the breach of Jerusalem, the destruction of our temple. Like, how are the things related? So let's look at source number two. And this is from Shemos. This is the actual text of when the Jewish people commit the grievous sin. They're at Sinai. 40 days and 40 nights, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses goes up the mountain. They don't hear from him. He promised he would return on the 40th day, but they erroneously miscalculated the return day just by a few hours. And so what happens? They pressure Aaron and Hur, who are left in charge. They murder Miriam's son, Hur, nephew of Moshe and Aaron, and they kind of force Aaron to go ahead and build the calf for them. He tries to delay, as we'll see in a moment. And ultimately, the calf is built. Moshe is told up on top of Mount Sinai, it's all over, get down. Your people destroyed themselves. They built a golden calf. Moshe, of course, Moses is struck without words to say. It's like probably the only time in his life that even though he's a lo ish devarim anochi, he says to God when he first meets God by the burning bush, I'm not a man of words. He's really good with magical words to pray on behalf of the Jewish people. He is so thunderstruck up the mountain that the Jewish people, literally sitting at the foot of Mount Sinai, 40 days removed from the Decalogue, the giving of the revelation of the Torah at Sinai, they're building a golden calf. So listen to this dialogue, okay? Source 2. And the Lord said to Moses, he says, go, lech raid, go down, for your people that you have brought up from the land of Egypt have acted corruptly. They have quickly turned away from the path that I commanded them. They have made themselves a molten calf. They have prostrated themselves before it. They slaughtered sacrifices to the calf. And then they announced, these are your gods, O Israel, who have brought you up from the land of Egypt. And the Lord said to Moses further, I have seen this people, meaning us, the Jewish people, and behold, Am She'oreth. They are this stiff-necked, stubborn people. And then God says to Moshe, now leave me alone, Moses. Cease and desist your prayers. Don't bother me with prayers of salvation for the Jews. Leave me alone, and my anger will be kindled against them so that I will annihilate them. And I will make you, Moses, into a great nation. Meaning, Moses, you and your wife are going to start again, sort of like Abraham and Sarah. I'm just going to wipe the slate clean and start with you. You're the only guy I trust. Now, Moses hears God throw a huge opening for him to pray. Did you catch that? He basically heard God say, leave me alone. Hanichali. Leave me alone. And Moses says to himself, but I haven't started to pray for the Jewish people. I didn't think, actually, that prayer at this point could be effective. I mean, really, the golden calf? And prayers are somehow going to mitigate what the Jewish people did with this heinous crime? So when God says stop praying, what does Moses say? Moses is smart, right? He says, oh, that's a cue. Moses is saying, God wants me to pray. So the next thing he says, Moses pleaded before the Lord his God and said, why, O Lord? Why should your great anger be kindled against your people whom you have brought up in the land of Egypt with great power and with a strong hand? Why should the Egyptians say, ha, God only brought them out with evil intent all along to kill them in the mountains and to annihilate them upon the face of the earth? Retreat from the heat of your anger, God, and reconsider the evil intended for your people. And that was the prayer that saved the Jewish people for the moment. Okay. Do you notice, though, that in Moshe's prayer, he's sort of, I don't want to call it minimizing what the Jewish people did, but he is explaining the Jewish people. Now, you may not have caught it, because the Midrash, the oral tradition, teaches us what he really meant. When God says, they're your people who you took out from the land of Egypt with great power, he's referring specifically to the gold of the golden calf. Where did the Jewish people get the gold? Well, you gave it to them, Hashem. You know, at the splitting of the sea, the Egyptians had adorned their chariots with massive amounts of gold in honor of murdering the Jews. And when the chariots were broken apart by the power of the splitting of the sea and the crushing waters that came down upon the Egyptians, all that gold washed up on the shore and the Jewish people had the gold. Ah, Moshe says. Okay, so let me get this right. The Jewish people, 49 days before they come to Sinai, they were worshiping gods, little lowercase gods in Egypt. They were idol worshippers. Okay, so you come to the Red Sea, you give them tons of gold. So you're basically giving an addict massive amounts of alcohol and drugs. And then you're saying, oh, I'm angry that you decided to imbibe. In fact, the Medrash says it much harsher. I'll tell you what the Medrash says. The Medrash equates it with a father who takes his son, gives him a bunch of cash, dresses him up in nice clothes, and drops him by a brothel. And the next day, he gets angry at him because the kid went into the brothel. That's sort of the analogy that the rabbis draw here. That Moshe was saying, you know, the gold was very tempting to them. What do you expect? They're little children. They're not a developed, nuanced nation yet. And furthermore, it really wasn't even the Jews. It was the Erevrav, the mixed multitude, the riffraff that we're really instigating. Be that as it may, it was the gold. So come on, have a little empathy, sympathy, and rahmanis, mercy on the Jewish people. And of course, God does. He says, okay, you know what? I'm going to give them a temporary respite. And then what does Moshe do? He comes down the mountain. Have a look at source 3. And look at the words of Moshe now. It happened as Moses, drew near the camp and saw the camp and the dancers, that Moses' anger flared up. He threw down the tablets from his hands, and he shattered them at the foot of the mountain. Now, wait a minute. This is the same Moshe who just a few verses earlier said, Hashem, why, O Lord, should your anger be against them? They're like little children. You gave them a bunch of gold. Okay, no. They built a golden calf. And by the way, just as a side point, the golden calf, according to the rabbis, was really not that far off, because the gold of the calf was replaced ultimately by the cherubs, the golden cherubim, which were in the Holy of Holies. One replaces the other. The major issue was that God did not ordain that a calf should be built. Okay, but that's a sideline. Now, getting back to the basis. Moshe acts very, I don't want to call it sort of nonchalant, but his defense of the Jewish people, he's sort of saying, Hashem, lama yechere akcha b'yamecha. Those are the words. They work better in the original text, okay? It's not on your screen, I'm sorry. Lama yechere akcha b'yamecha. God, why should your anger go against the Jews? I'm going to take everybody off the sheet because I'm getting tired of looking at the same screen. I'm going to end my broadcast so I can actually see some human beings as well as the lovely, handsome faces of the men and people with me. Hello, everyone. Okay. So let us now try to understand why, when Moses is up on the summit, the top of Sinai, he's very, like, they say, fair. Come on, God. Why are you getting angry? They're little children. And then he comes down, and what does he do? He sees the calf. Boom! He goes ballistic. He smashes the calf and destroys it. Then they gather the Levites around him, your guys, and he goes and he executes judgment against anyone who was involved in the Cheta Egel, son of the golden calf. Why such a change in Moses' temperament? Now, you could say, and I think this is a very good approach, the simplest approach would be that when someone tells you about something, even God, and it's conceptual, it's only in your mind, that's one impact. It's less of an impact. When you see it visually and you experience it, much more persuasive, much more powerful. So up on the mountain, even though he's told by God, who's a pretty good witness, what has transpired, it's in his mind's eye. When he comes down and sees the reality of the calf and the people bowing to this calf, he goes ballistic. So that would be a very conventional, and I think a very true approach of what is going on, okay? But let me try to focus in on that, and maybe something else is going on here. But I'm not going to spoil it by telling you right now. I'll come back, so just file away the question in your mind. I'll come back in about 5-6 minutes, ready? So here's the question. How come Moshe on the top of Mount Sinai is very relaxed, laissez-faire? Come on, the Jews are like children with the gold. No, be forgiving, you're God. But when he comes down, it's a whole different Moshe. He acts viscerally, with anger, destroying the tablets. Okay? Before I give you that answer, I want to touch on the idea of women. Now, you will notice, and if you haven't noticed, you're going to notice right now, that the ladies of our lives, the ladies of the Torah, not once did they participate in the mishugas, the nonsense that the men participated in. So let's just go piece by piece. When the mob surrounds Aaron and says, Aaron, build us a golden calf, Aaron has a plan. You know what his plan is? He says, go to your wives. This is source number 4, which you'll get online. I'm not going to show it to everybody at home. He says, go to your wives and ask for the jewelry that they got in Egypt from the Red Sea. And he knows, does Aaron, that the Jewish women, first of all, love their jewelry, and they're also not stupid. They are not going to participate in some absurd building a golden calf. They're not little children. And they knew that there would be an argument, husband versus wife, wife versus husband, and there would be frying pans thrown in the tents. And by the time the men would come back with some gold, Moshe would have returned and saved the day. Because Moses was only a few hours removed from a safe return, everything would be okay. Now, he underestimated the power of the Yetzirah, how overwhelmed with desire these riffraff Egyptian converts were, that they literally pulled their own gold out of the ears. Chazal, or rabbis say, actually pieces of the ear were still connected. They were so overwhelmed with this need to build this calf. And the immediacy of their response undermined Aaron's plan. Okay, but you see something spectacular. The women were not going to be participants in the golden calf, and they were not. Let's fast forward now. What about the spies? Again, did the women participate? No. The women weren't sentenced to walk around and die in the desert. It was a generation of the men between 20 and 60, not the women. Time and time again, the men get involved in sin. Nothing much, I guess, has changed over the years. The men get involved in mishugas and sin, and it's the ladies who are there to kick them in the pants and hopefully save the day, right? Okay, now that is germane. It's germane because of source number 5, okay? Ready for this one? I'm going to read it to you outside because nobody on our Zoom call has this text in front of you. So there's a Mishnah, an oral law, in Tractate Ta'anit, and it discusses the happiest days of the year. You ready? Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who was the great Nasi, the prince of Israel, he said that Israel, the Jewish people, have no greater joyful days, days of Simcha, than Tu B'Av, the 15th day of Av, not Tisha B'Av, not the 9th of Av, 6 days later, Tu B'Av, the 15th of Av, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Yom Kippur and Tu B'Av are the most joyous days of the year. Now, I don't know about you, but Yom Kippur, it's a kind of a mixed bag, right? Because you got the fast. It's not an easy day. But I could understand Yom Kippur, right? Why would Yom Kippur be so great? Because it's my opportunity to reinvent myself, to recreate myself, to make it right in my relationship with God. So even though it's a difficult day, it's a challenging day, it's 25 hours of prayers and crying and beseeching and stripping bare my soul to God, it's ultimately a day of great joy when you get through the day and you live and you recreate yourself and you return to God with tshuva. But what about this Tu B'Av, this little 15th day of Av? Well, what is it all about? Other than not saying Tachanun, what's the significance? So the Mishnah goes on to say that on both the 15th day of Av and the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippurim, the daughters of Israel would go out dressed in white, which were all borrowed in order not to shame anyone who didn't have a suitable white dress. And the daughters of Jerusalem would go out and dance in the vineyards. And what would they say? They would say to the young men assembled there, unmarried young men, unmarried young women. They would say to the young men, Bachur, young man, lift up your eyes and see what you choose for yourself. Don't set your eyes upon beauty, rather set your eyes upon family. For grace is false, beauty is vain, as we say every Friday night to the ladies in Eshes Chayil, a woman who fears Hashem, he sees halal, she should be praised. Okay, let's try to understand this, and you will see, remarkably, I believe, how this all fits together, okay? So on the 15th day of Av, 6 days removed from Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, the daughters of Jerusalem who were unmarried would get dressed up, as they say in Yiddish, they would get all farpitzed. They go out into the field, and apparently they set up a whole, like a bunch of chairs, I guess, for the young men who were not married, and the young ladies would dance for them. Now, I always make the joke when I say this Mishnah over, I think if we did this today, we would have no shidduch crisis. We would have no crisis of young, unmarried men or women. Because let me tell you, if this happened, the guys are going to be Twitter-pated, right, to use a Bambi term, and we're not going to have any issue of young unmarried men or women, no issue of Jewish singles. Now, I want you to think about something. What was the only piece of information that Moses lacked on the summit of Sinai that he saw when he descended from Sana. Did you pay attention to it? I'll tell you. When he's up the mountain, God says, Moses, Shichei Samcha, your people have been corrupted. They made an eagle, a golden calf. And how does Moshe react? God, Lama Yecharabcha Be'amecho, why are you getting so hot under the collar? The Jewish people are young, they're neophytes, they're not used to religion, you gave a bunch of gold, please forgive them. But then when Moshe comes down, it says he saw the calf with his own eyes, boom, he viscerally destroys the calf. What did he see? He didn't just see the calf. Did you pay attention? It says that as he came near, I'll read it to you in Hebrew. Vayika shekarav al machaneh. And it was in Moshe's source number 3, you'll see it at home, when he came near the camp, vayarese egel, and he saw the calf. Extra word here, ladies and gentlemen. Umicholot. And he saw the dances. The dances. In other words, up on Mount Sinai, God didn't mention dancing. He just said they built a golden calf. So that Moshe could accept. Please, God, forgive them. He comes down. He sees the calf that he already knew about. But there's one little bit of information that he wasn't told by God yet. The mecholot, the dances. The dances. Now, why should the dances make such a difference? You see, because dancing is not only expressing exuberance and a joy, it is giving substance to something. You're celebrating something as a reality. So you can imagine, the Jewish people are down below, there's a calf, and they're having like the hora line around the calf, and they're all dancing, and they're pointing at the calf, and they're saying, Eila Elohecha Yisrael, this is your God, Israel. When Moses saw the dance, he thought, oh my gosh, chaval, I knew they built the calf, which is a projection of the mind. It's not reality, it's an invention. It's just their illusion, the grand illusion. But by dancing around it and pointing to it as if it's real, how do we go back from that moment? The only way back, DEFCON number 5. You blow up the calf. That was the response of Moshe. Now, why is this so amazing? Who was not there at the calf? The women weren't there. Remember, the women didn't even want to give their jewelry, so the men had to get their own jewelry to manufacture the calf. The women weren't there dancing, because when the men dance, they dance in a sexual, promiscuous, idolatrous way. Everything bad, the dark side. But when the ladies dance on Tu B'Av, and they say to the young unmarried men, please come pick one of us to be your mate, that is a different type of dance. That is a dance not celebrating illusion, it's celebrating life, what could be still. Let's have a life. Let's look at reality. And I believe that the women in the wilderness, like our women today, have a grasp on reality. They see through the illusion. And that's why they didn't want to bother with the fake out of the spies and the maligning of Israel, or the fake out of the golden calf. The women see through it. It's a facade. It's not real. It's an illusion. So that's why the women don't participate in it. They see reality. The men didn't. The men were faked out by the allure, the grand illusion. And what is the golden calf? It's idolatry at its essence. Okay, now how does that relate to the breach of the wall of Jerusalem? Very simply, what caused the destruction of Jerusalem? The second temple, we are told, sinas chinam, baseless hatred. So when I say it's baseless, what does that mean? It's not real. It's a fake out, fake hatred. So you see, it's the same issue. Jerusalem and the issue of the golden calf are linked one to the next. They're nested within each other. In other words, we wouldn't know that at the time. In other words, we didn't know that at the time that the golden calf happens because of non-reality and a belief in an illusion, right? We didn't know that that same issue would destroy the temple of Jerusalem on the same day. The breach at Sinai is the breach of Jerusalem. They're one and the same. It's a continuum. So when we say history is nested, we're saying that the same issue was never properly addressed at Sinai, this ability to buy into non-reality of Avodah Zarah, because that is the ultimate expression of non-reality, idolatry. And when we buy into idolatry, it's a fake out, it's an illusion. And that was never satisfactorily addressed, at least not completely. It was a cancer that plagued the Jews for hundreds and hundreds of years, culminating in a baseless hatred. Again, anything baseless, non-objective as a truth, is, again, a form of idolatry. And so it permeated the Jewish people. It was an underlying malignancy that ultimately destroys the temple all those hundreds and hundreds of years later. They're one and the same. Now, where do we go from here? If it's a malignancy that we couldn't address then, how do we address it now? I think I touched on that. It's the dance. We need the ladies of our lives, and we can join them in the dance. The dance is always a metaphor for life. A lot of poets have written and used the word, the dance. Life is a dance. It's a very limited dance. It's 120 years or less. And the ladies of our lives have a unique ability always to see what is still possible in our lives. In the darkness of Egypt, it was the women who were able to see through the darkness and see a redemption. The Nashim Sikonios, the righteous women, who literally brought the men along with them. It was the women dancing. Remember what they were doing at the sea? They were playing music and dancing to celebrate the miracle of the sea. And it will be the ultimate dance of Tu B'Av, when the women are dancing and saying to the young men, you know, young man, I know you're not married yet, but there's possibilities here. You know, choose. If you want beauty, you want genetics, you want yichus, you want a God-fearing woman, just choose somebody. There is still life to be lived. Reality, real life. And should be that we as the Jewish people try to work on this, because clearly it hasn't been addressed satisfactorily. You know what my sad truth is for everyone tonight? We don't have a third temple yet, do we? Think about it for a moment. How long did the first temple remain destroyed? 70 years. And what were the three sins that destroyed the first temple? The big cardinal sins, right? Shfichas Dami, murder, Avodah Zarah, idolatry, and Gilui Arayos, immorality. It only took 70 years for Esther, Mordechai, and the Jewish people to come back, and we built temple number two. But how long has it been since temple two was destroyed? It's almost 2,000 years. And that tells us something, that this idolatry, whatever you want to call it in today's 2021 terminology, the idolatry, the baseless fake out, a belief in things that aren't real, it still permeates our world more than ever. And it's an underlying, perhaps root cause why we can't see the Geula. We're not yet ready for Mashiach, for the Messiah to come. And it should be that perhaps with the zchus, the merit of our wonderful women of our lives, that we can reach out for the dance of life, for the mecholos, for the dance that can save us and bring us the ultimate redemption.